This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
For the sake of accomplishing the welfare of all beings, I freely give up all of my virtues of the three times. Surrendering everything is nirvana, and my mind seeks nirvana, and so I surrender everything, and it is best to give it to sentient beings. Just as the earth and other elements are useful in various ways to innumerable sentient beings dwelling throughout infinite space, so may I be in various ways a source of life for the sentient beings present throughout space until they're all liberated. So I myself shall generate the spirit of awakening for the sake of the world. And so I myself shall properly engage in these essential practices. This is some of the teachings of Shantideva, the Bodhisattva guide, a guide to a Bodhisattva way of life. And the Bodhisattva is an enlightened being, Bodhi, enlightened, and Sattva means being, who in early Buddhism was the life of the Buddha, a practitioner, practicing and developing oneself in this life through successive lifetimes to eventually be reborn as a Buddha, Shakyamuni in our most recent case. In the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva came to be the vow of the practice of a practitioner to liberate the suffering of self and other, to work for the welfare of self and other. And so yesterday I drew from a teaching by Master Dogen on the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance, and this is a basic teaching, but I was drawing on Dogen's particular comments about this. And so I touched on the first of these, which is non-greed, and the second, which was loving words. So today I want to speak about the other two, the remaining two. Before I do that, because I forgot yesterday, there are two things I wanted to mention that just were apropos of things coming up in Dokusan. And things, and they come up a lot in practice. One is that when we talk about detachment in Dharma practice, you know, that's a word in English that refers to something that is being cultivated in our practice. And detachment can have the sense of distance, aloofness. Being detached means being far away, can even suggest a kind of uncaring quality. That's not what detachment means in Buddhism. It's immediate, it's present, it's alive, but it is not entangled. That's the key. And so it's the opposite of what happens with distance, is that with intimacy, with closeness, with directness, there is, because we're not entangled, there is immediacy. The Buddha spoke of becoming disenchanted. So he, after his enlightenment, considered not teaching because he said, as he surveyed the landscape of human beings, he said, we are so enchanted with our delusions, so enchanted with our attachments, that he thought no one's going to want to give them, to let them go. But then he changed his mind. Good for us. And so just so that's clear, because, you know, language is so powerful. I talked about this yesterday. And that's one reason the Buddha taught so much about language, because it's how we create karma, negative and helpful. It's how we receive the teachings, much of the teachings is through language. It's how we, in excess, in a sense, express the teachings back to ourselves. you know, as we reflect on them and give rise to our own internal dialogue. And so if we think that practice is about detaching, which means distancing, becoming aloof, you know, uncaring, then that's what we'll practice, right, to try and fulfill. And so how we understand the language of Buddhism is extremely important. That's why right understanding is one of the first, is the first of the Eightfold Path. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that, you know, I often speak about in Zazen, the posture is in a state of equanimity or a state of perfect merging between wakefulness and ease. And the challenge with that is when we come into practice, I think all of us come in with quite a bit of tension. Right? Does that seem reasonable to say? Quite a bit of tension, whether we're aware of it or not. And a lot of it, I think, most of us are not aware of, which is why sitting down in Zazen in stillness is such a kind of a radical thing. Because even if we've been very much in our bodies and sort of connected to our bodies in certain ways, when we sit and sit in stillness, that shows, will reveal sort of the seams of our tension. And then when we're trying to concentrate, particularly in the beginning when our minds are wild, the way we tend to concentrate is through effort, which is necessary, but the effort that we tend to exert is based in that sort of embodied habit of tension, and so it's very forceful. And that leads to not a state of ease and a very brittle kind of wakefulness. And so over time, what we're trying to cultivate is a bright and clear mind and a complete state of ease within the body, which is also in the mind. And so both the body and mind are bright and clear and at ease and relaxed. And so it's just good to be aware of that so that as you're sitting, if you experience or experiencing tension, that you try and relax that. And then if you become too relaxed, so that the mind becomes, you know, distracted and sort of, you know, just wandering, then you sharpen that. And over time, you know, this isn't something we figure out. It's not like a perfect battle, like, you know, mixing two ingredients together until you find the right. It's something we experience, and we have to experience it over time. But if we're aware of that, then we can actually do that. So that plays very much into being a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas aren't uptight, right? Though they can start out that way. So, you know, I want to start with these words of Shantideva because he speaks in, as the teachings often do, in a very highly, not just aspirational, but he's in a sense presenting us with the complete embodiment of an enlightened being. So what is it like to be a perfectly enlightened being? And so recognizing that we seek peace, we seek cessation of suffering, we seek nirvana, and we realize that in order to do that, we have to surrender everything that we are holding on to. Views, objects, desires, fears, identities, and recognizing that attachment is just mind, right? Attachment is not in an object, it's not in a person, it's not in a thing. And recognizing that the only way to experience, to bring ourselves to closer and into that state of cessation of suffering is by surrendering our suffering itself, which is just another way of speaking of attachments. And drawing an example from the earth where all of the elements, earth, air, fire, water, space, and consciousness in the human realm are useful in various ways. Everything is made up of those elements. And that benefits everybody. And so using that as an example, that I vowed that I want to use all of those elements within myself, everything that I have, right, to both benefit myself because I'm trying to make myself a vehicle. I want to be a vessel, right? A bodhisattva is a vessel for wisdom and compassion. And so it needs to be a good vessel. And so I want to use all of those resources within myself to develop within myself everything that everyone else has the capacity to develop. So he ends, I'll generate bodhicitta, the spirit of awakening, not just for myself, but for the sake of the world. And so I myself shall properly engage in those practices. What are those practices? Non-greed, loving words, beneficial action, identity action. The other two I'll speak about now. And so all of this works together. And it's both, as I spoke about yesterday, as Dogen spoke, that we, in giving and practicing generosity, we are giving to ourselves, right? And practitioners of the Dharma, particularly Mahayana practitioners, Bodhisattva practitioners, it's like, oh. No, I'm supposed to be giving to everybody else, right? Put others before ourselves. And I said yesterday, that's understanding that we naturally put ourselves forward, right? I cited the Buddha who said, you know, who do you care about more than anyone else in the world? And the Buddha said, you. You care about yourself more than anyone else in the world. And that's sort of a normal way of being, right? That we are most close to ourselves, right? When we're hungry, we're the first ones to know it. When we're tired, we know it, right? When we're in pain, we know it. And we're immediately drawn to address that within ourselves. And what I said was that when we do that and are actually serving ourselves, then that's not a selfish act. Because we're taking care within the Bodhisattva vow, we're taking care of this so that we can be healthy and high-spirited, so that we can help serve others, and also so we can know what does that actually mean? How do we serve? How can I know that if I haven't applied all of those practices and teachings towards myself and seen how do they work, right? What is useful? What is not useful? And so Dogen says, beneficial action is to skillfully benefit all types of sentient beings. That is to care about their distant and their near future and to help them by using skillful means. In ancient times, someone helped a caged tortoise. Another person took care of an injured sparrow. They didn't expect a reward. They were just moved to do so only for the sake of beneficial action. They were moved to do so because they saw something that was suffering and they wanted to attend to that. And so to skillfully benefit all kinds of sentient beings, all classes is actually the word that is translated here. And skillful here is not just to have good skills, though that's important. Skills like communication, like knowing how to relate to people, like knowing ourselves, knowing how to practice. But skillfulness in Buddhism arises directly from wisdom, right? And it's like a marriage between fundamental wisdom, right, which is free of time and space, and a marriage of that with conventional wisdom, being worldly, right, being street smart, knowing how things work, understanding history, understanding human beings, systems. And when those come together, they can be very powerful. And so understanding, and so our practice, as we try to alleviate our suffering, is to study suffering. Which means to study all of the human endeavor. It's to study desire. It's to study faith. It's to study hope and hopelessness. It's to study aspiration and indifference. It's to study patience and impatience. It's to study the samsaric self, the karmic self, and the self that is empty. all classes of being, rich and poor, young and old, every being. And that's, and so in that study, we're also studying what makes us unskillful. What creates distance? What dissolves that distance? I was thinking of this in terms of the Beyond Fear work. You know, because so much of practice is studying the self, which in a certain way, in the beginning of practice, we're blind to. We don't really see it. We don't see this as the self. We don't see the world as the self. We just see it as a world. We just see this as me. And those seem like just self-evident truths. They just are. We don't see them as a result of an interdependent web of conditions and karmic actions that exist, that come to be in a certain moment and then pass, arise in a moment and pass, arise in a moment and pass, and that life is nothing but that series of moments. That's all. We don't see that. We see it as a continuum, solid, permanent, identity-rich reality that is apart from ourselves. Even this is apart from ourselves. That's what a soul is, right? Something that abides within us for a while but isn't really us and then moves on. And so I was thinking this in terms of, you know, studying racism, all forms of bias, so that with any dominant group, whether it's white entitlement, male entitlement, heterosexual entitlement, the unseen nature of that entitlement that is unseen by design. It's unseen to keep it in place. Just like samsara is invisible to keep it in place so that it keeps moving without our seeming needing to do anything. In fact, if we don't do anything, it just keeps rolling out. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha said that to bring loving kindness to the weak and the strong, the seen and the unseen, those born and those yet to be born. That's the view of the Bodhisattva. That's the reach. Right. I mean, think of the Buddha seeing this 2,500 years ago. You know, in a time where awareness was, ordinary awareness was limited to what we could see, right? To whatever news we could know about that was traveling on foot. And to think about how prescient he was in terms of our time now. You know, that our actions today are creating, right, the abundance or the impoverishment of people hundreds of years from now that we'll never meet. In a sense, we're giving or stealing from those born and yet to be born. And so the Bodhisattva is cultivating that kind of view, which can't happen if we're self-absorbed. I was reading an article on empathy in which it was talking about, it was asking people, what are the most important things in terms of certain categories? And so it said that white college-educated Americans are far less likely to say poverty is a critical issue and are also less likely than non-college whites to say that children living in poverty is a critical issue to them, right? So when the question is, what's important to you? What are the important issues to you, right? What is the you? Is it just what I directly experience? So I'm not impoverished, so poverty is not a critical issue for me. My children don't live in poverty, so children living in poverty is not an issue for me. It's not important, right? And sort of a perfect expression of the self, right? Clinging to the self. And it went on down. Only 33% of white college-educated respondents said that domestic violence was important. Other groups naturally said it was critically important. And so on. And so what the Buddha realized is that, as Dogen said, that our ability to see, which means perceive, experience, understand, care about, is limited by the extent of our penetrating vision. Penetrating, which sees through this apparent barrier. This sees through just the particular aspects of my life, as though that's the world everybody lives in, or that's the only world that matters, because it matters to me. And so how do we feel empathy towards those that we don't see? You know, particularly for those of us who live in segregated communities. How do we care about others? Because empathy naturally arises, or more easily arises, when we're in contact. Particularly when somebody I care about is being hurt. It's natural. It's a sign of good spiritual health to feel empathy, to be empathetic. When there's more distance, that empathy becomes much more precarious. And so the bodhisattva is both, you know, wanting to be in contact with people. I mean, in a sense, that's what we're letting down. That's what those boundaries are, our boundaries of segregation between good and bad, right and wrong, light and dark, heaven and hell, white and black and brown. Rich and poor. But how do we care when we're not in direct contact with someone who is suffering? What is the experience of the bodhisattva when the self drops away? I talked yesterday about the seeming urge within human beings of all cultures and times and religions that seems to move towards some sense of vastness, boundlessness, expansiveness, the absolute God. And what is that within us that has some sense that life can't just be about this small individual thing? And that when we stand in the midst of something large, that there's that sense of awe, and also perhaps of what? What is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? I think of so much of practice, really any spiritual practice, is really just responding to what to these deep, deep impulses that we have within us that understand something essential, and in a sense understand everything that's essential, but it is deep within our consciousness and is not in our knowing mind. It's not within the realm of our perceptions. So the Buddha said after his enlightenment, this dharma is subtle and profound and difficult to perceive. It cannot be perceived by the senses. We can't know it that way. And so that's why we do zazen. Right? By allowing those senses to be so open, so unhindered, that they come by being fully awake and fully at rest, they are seen through. And we, in a sense, make contact. Dogen says, foolish people think, or deluded people think, that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. If I give to you, then I have less. If I take care of you, what about me? And he says, but this isn't so. That's not the way it works. Beneficial action is an act of unity, benefiting self and other at the same time. Now, of course, this beneficial action he's speaking about is just another form of giving, but it's specific. It's giving in a way that is benefiting, an action that is benefiting. which means it's arising perhaps out of an intention. And so when we don't feel inclined towards beneficial action, we can practice it, right? That's what the precepts teach. So when I'm feeling inclined to be stingy, I don't really want to share this with you. Because I am practicing opening my heart, right? I've made a commitment to not perpetuate, cultivate, strengthen, have faith in my greed, my stinginess. And perhaps I have already tasted the truth of that, that in that moment then I am able to practice letting go of or extending myself through that stinginess to you. It's conscious, it's deliberate, there's tension there, because I both want to extend that to you and I also want to keep it for myself. But I know this, I am conscious of this. I am doing this within an awake mind, and that is most powerful. You know, we tend to think in so much in absolutes, like if it's not pure, purely beneficial, pure giving, purely selfish, selfishness, selflessness, then it's all selfish. And that's not true. I mean, if that was true, then your zazen is either completely, perfectly embodied, enlightened, or it's complete delusion. And you know that that's not true, right? Most of the time, we know that's not true. Sometimes we might feel like we are utterly and absolutely deluded. Or enlightened, for that matter. And so that's what allows this revolution to take place. And that's what allows it, that is our seat of power, that within the midst and the recognition, the honest recognition of that entanglement, that enchantment, that small-mindedness, that we can recognize that I see you. I see you. And I choose this. I make an offering. How powerful is that? And then there is developing that, cultivating that, so that there are moments where there is no hindrance. There's just offering. It's not generosity. It's not non-greed. It's not practice. It's just offering. It's just doing what is to be done. Self and other, it's what Dogen is speaking about. It is that action of unity. Beneficial action is an act of unity, benefiting self and others together, and ultimately transcending self and other. There is no sense of giving, no sense of receiving. Living in intimate contact. Everything that arises has influence. That's what we realize in practice. Nothing has no impact. Some impacts are small and slight. Some are very large. Some change us in very insignificant ways we hardly notice, and some in very profound ways in which you know that your life has changed in this moment. The Buddha realized that in that web, we are utterly dependent upon each other. And that is a good thing. It's actually not even a good thing. It's just the thing. Like we might think that the sun rising every morning is a good thing. But that's not why the sun does it. Right? So Dogen says, thus benefit friend and enemy equally, benefit self and others alike. If you have this heart, then even beneficial action for the sake of grass or trees, wind and water, is spontaneous and unremitting. This being so, make a wholehearted effort to help. A wholehearted effort to help. And this, I mentioned yesterday, is I think the most challenging spiritual practice of all. It's easy to benefit a friend. It can even be easy to benefit a stranger. But to deeply and genuinely want to benefit an enemy is hard. To have this heart. And so that's why we have practices to cultivate that heart. And that means first we have to acknowledge that we have that feeling towards this person. A feeling of anger, a feeling of hatred, a feeling of bitterness, a feeling of resentment. Right? If practice isn't honest, it kind of isn't really practice, you know. But again, nothing is really absolute. So in a moment of not being honest, it's not completely not honest. In other words, we have the capacity to see and not see at the same time. Right? To be true and false at the same moment. And then it's recognizing, you know, what is it to live in a way that's not true? Do I want to continue that? Is that what I want to put my vital energies into? What is it to live in a way that is true? How's that when that's what's the show that's playing? Is that what I want to cultivate? And so we study and we make vows. We establish intentions. And we have to keep turning towards what we want to turn away from. And so beneficial action is just to continually want to be a benefit. To who? Everyone. When? Always. In what ways? Every way. And so that doesn't become vague and abstract, I care about everyone all the time. I promise. Right? We have to ourselves live that and be willing to challenge ourselves to live that and see the ways in which our minds, our habits, still unseen, still have power. And that exists within just studying the Dharma and sort of the traditional ways of seeing the self. It exists in terms of living within this time and culture. So what does that mean for a white person? What does that mean for a man? What does that mean for a woman? What does it mean for a person of color? What does it mean for somebody who's straight, somebody who's not straight? What does that mean in terms of these different identities and how they relate to other identities? What does it mean in terms of how it relates within the systems that are created to benefit some and expressly hurt others? What does that mean? And when I say that Buddhism doesn't solve our problems, right? It doesn't tell us what to do in this situation, right? In the same way, it doesn't tell us how, you know, what we need to pay attention to. You know, the Buddha didn't say you need to study racism, you need to study sexism, right? In a sense, he wasn't trying to disrupt society directly. He was trying to disrupt the samsara that exists within each one of us. And through that, to bring forth a more enlightened society. So in a sense, we have to, as we're letting the house fall apart, not create another house, but protect the space within which that house exists. Identity action, Dogen says, means non-difference. It is non-difference from self, non-difference from others, non-discrimination, non-differentiation. For example, in the human world, the Buddha took the form of a human being in his lifetime. And from this, we know that he did the same in other realms. When we know identity action, we realize self and others as one. Now here, Dogen is obviously speaking about identity in a different way. So there's identity, my sense of self, and all the different aspects of that, that I cling to, that I see myself as, that goes into creating my sense of who I am, that is different from you, that is separate from you, and that sets us up in tension with each other. He's using identity as unity in this case. Unity action is based in non-differentiation, non-discrimination, the realization that all beings have one nature, that across the expanse, the surface of the ocean that has an infinite number of waves, that all of those are nothing but the ocean. Not the same, not different. Non-dual, beyond sameness and difference. Ultimately beyond empathy. Using empathy because it's so powerful, but not dependent upon empathy. In the same way that as a practitioner, it is useful when you feel invigorated to practice, motivated to practice. That's very useful. If you're dependent upon that, you're already in trouble. Because there will be many days when you wake up and you don't feel that. And that's true with any alive relationship we have, whether it's work or raising a child or having an intimate relationship. If we rely on feelings as always being present to motivate us to live within and give ourselves to that relationship, it's going to be very mercurial, right? Depends on what the weather is today. And so it's useful when those elements are present, but we need to also develop a deeper faith, a deeper resourcefulness. And so we need to be dedicated to alleviating suffering, even when we're not of others, even when we're not directly in the face of that suffering. How do we do that? We have to reach beyond our immediate experience. Dogen quotes an old teaching that says, the ocean doesn't exclude water, that's why it's so large. The mountain doesn't exclude soil, that's why it's so high. And that the ocean doesn't exclude water is identity action. The action of water is the ocean. The action of ocean is water. This being so, water comes together to form the ocean. They form each other. Enlightenment and delusion heal each other. We couldn't practice without our delusion. It doesn't make sense. And so it's our very delusion. It's our suffering. It's our attachments. And that is not intended to enshrine them. It's noble to suffer, therefore suffer more. That's not what that means. It just means there is distress, there is despondency, there is fear, there is the many forms of suffering that we experience, disappointment and dissatisfaction. Use them. That we learn how to put them to use through practice to enlighten us to their fundamental nature, to awaken the heart of compassion. And that's why exclusion, to create exclusion in a society, within a sangha, within ourselves, is a kind of primordial transgression, because it goes against the very basic nature of who we are and what all things are, which is why that in every society, that in every relationship, can only create pain and anguish. And so how do we live in this world? How do we carry out our responsibilities? How do we, you know, relate to other people? How do we work in which sometimes we need to be critical of others' actions or behavior? And how do we do that without cultivating greed and anger and hatred? How do we hold ourselves and others accountable in a way that is responsible but without bringing forth ill will? That's the great challenge. Because the ocean doesn't exclude water, it is large. Because the sky doesn't exclude anything, it is vast. How is that for us? Because the self does not exclude anything. It's boundless. This is non-greed. And based in that, we can practice and bring forth more naturally loving words and beneficial actions. And based in the practice of that, we begin to realize, experience directly, identity action, self and other merging, falling away. You know, compassion is something in Buddhism that, you know, is very powerful and very attractive. It attracts many people to Buddhist practice. And that's good. It's also important to appreciate that it is the most challenging aspect, not just of practice, but of life. To truly practice compassion will kick your butt over and over and over and over. It kicks my butt over and over and over and over. And what that means is it reveals to me my lack of compassion. That in trying to see clearly and care, it reveals to me when I'm not seeing clearly and when I'm not caring. And that hurts. And so part of practice is not defending ourselves against that pain, but learning how to build up resilience and patience within that discomfort. And that as we both take it very personally as my responsibility, but not take it personally as this is who I am, therefore I need to defend myself, then I'm much more free to listen, to reflect, to learn, to develop, to respond, and to do that over and over and over and over. So I'll end with a poem. And this is sort of inspired by the poem that I wrote for the holiday card that some of you might have received. But we're in the city, so it was inspired by the city. Walking down the city street, head down, deep in thought, I raise my eyes and am stopped. Mother and child, stopped. Man muttering aimlessly, stopped. Old woman walking painfully, stopped. Each and every carries the causes and conditions completely. This is the gate with a boundless heart for all people, for all things. Each carries the causes and conditions completely. This is something that I think each of us should study and study and study. And that this is the very gate. So, have a nice holiday, whatever that means to you. And a happy new year, a good new year. And we'll be doing, Hojin Sensei will be here next week, and we'll be doing a New Year sit and entering here. And then, of course, up at the monastery, we'll be doing Rahatsu Sesshin and ending with the New Year's service. And if you're here, then you'll be invited to offer incense and make a vow. And if you're somewhere else, I encourage you to do the same. You know, New Year's is a convention, like we made it up. But having made it up, let's use it. Right? Why not? And so we can see it as the end of something, the beginning of something new. And it's a wonderful practice to stop and reflect and consider this new year, this period of time, this life force. What do I want to pay attention to? What is important that I need to pay attention to within myself? What do I need to pay attention to with regards to you? And to bring forth that into a vow. That's our power. Let's not waste it.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.